Nemoto presents pioneers of psychology and psychiatry. Eric Erickson, The Eight Ages of the Self. Narrated with Microsoft Azure using the Christopher voice. Running time, approximately 22 minutes. A fair-haired boy of about 10 stands outside his school in Karlsruhe, Germany, clutching his satchel and fighting back tears. It is the early 1910s, and young Eric Homburger, not yet Eric Erickson, has just endured another confusing day of taunts. At his Jewish temple school, his classmates sneered that he looked too Aryan, calling him goy and outsider because of his blue eyes and blonde hair. But in the neighborhood streets, other children chased and mocked him with anti-Semitic slurs, seeing only that he was being raised in a Jewish household. Eric doesn't know where he belongs. He feels he doesn't fully fit in either world. That evening after dinner, he screws up the courage to ask the question that has been haunting him, "Mother, why am I so different?" His mother, Carla, pauses, then takes a deep breath. It is time to tell the truth she has hidden for so long. Gently, she explains that Theodore, the man who raised Eric, is not his biological father. She reveals that she had Eric out of wedlock, and that his birth father, a Danish man whom Eric has never met, abandoned them before he was born. In 1905, she married Dr. Theodore Homburger. In 1908, Eric Salomonsen's name was changed to Eric Homburger, and in 1911 he was officially adopted by his stepfather. Carla and Theodore told Eric that Theodore was his real father, only revealing the truth to him in late childhood. He remained bitter about the deception all his life. Now, as his mother speaks, Eric's world tilts. He feels an almost physical sensation of the ground shifting beneath him. The boy who had been called Eric Homburger suddenly doesn't know who he is. His mother's revelation lights up so many past shadows. His sense of not belonging, the questions about why he looked different from his father, but it also leaves him with a deeply unsettled heart. Later in life, Eric would recall this moment as the genesis of his own identity confusion, a state he described as being on the borderline between neurosis and adolescent psychosis. The pain and confusion of that night would echo through his work, leading him to a groundbreaking idea, that forming one's identity is the paramount struggle of youth, one that can reverberate throughout a lifetime. Eric Erickson was born Eric Salomonsen on June 15, 1902, in Frankfurt, Germany. His biological father's disappearance and his mother's secret remarriage meant that Eric spent the first years of his life with an identity inherited from a lie. For a long time he believed he was Eric Homburger, only to discover, as we have seen, that he was not. Carla was Jewish and Theodore Homburger was also Jewish, so Eric was raised in that faith. Yet physically he resembled his unknown Nordic father. This accident of fate made him a target in both Jewish and Gentile circles, instilling in him from an early age a sense of otherness and an acute sensitivity to acceptance and rejection. Eric later realized that this double marginalization, being both an insider and an outsider everywhere, planted the seeds of his fascination with identity. How does one forge a stable sense of self amid conflicting messages of who one is supposed to be? In school, Eric was bright but not particularly driven. He was far more interested in sketching and daydreaming than in earning top grades. When he graduated from gymnasium high school, his performance was mediocre. Theodore, his stepfather, a respected pediatrician, expected Eric to follow a conventional path, perhaps studying medicine. But Eric had other ideas. In a quiet act of rebellion and self-definition, he decided to attend art school in Munich instead. His mother, remembering her own youthful defiance, supported his choice. So the tall, introspective young man set off to become an artist. At the art academy, he learned painting and drawing, and for a while he reveled in bohemian freedom. This was Eric's attempt to carve out an identity of his own, separate from the Homburger name and expectations. With a paintbrush in hand and a canvas before him, he felt a sense of autonomy, a chance to shape something in his own image. Still, the questions of who am I and where do I belong lingered. In his early 20s, Eric did what many restless young souls of his era did. He traveled. Along with a childhood friend, he wandered through Italy and Germany, living as a kind of wanderer, an itinerant artist and tutor. He sketched landscapes and portraits to earn meals, slept in hostels or under the stars, and soaked in the art and history of Europe. During this period of drifting, Eric was searching, consciously or not, for a sense of purpose. He later likened this period to an identity crisis of his own, long before he coined that term formally. Though he enjoyed the camaraderie of fellow travelers and the beauty of the road, a part of him remained unsettled, waiting for a clear calling to emerge. That calling arrived in a roundabout way in 1927. By then, Eric had returned to Germany and was working as an art teacher for children. One of his artist acquaintances, Peter Bloss, suggested that Eric consider a position in Vienna. There was a progressive school there run by Dorothy Burlingame and Anna Freud, Sigmund Freud's daughter, for the children of psychoanalysts and their friends. They needed someone who could teach art and also be a kind of tutor/mentor to the children. Eric, still something of a free spirit, said yes and traveled to Vienna for what he thought might be a short stint. Instead, this opportunity changed the trajectory of his life. In Vienna, Eric found himself at the epicenter of the psychoanalytic movement. He taught art to the children in the morning and, to his surprise, found that he had a real knack for connecting with them. Anna Freud noticed how naturally Eric engaged with the kids. He would draw with them, tell them stories, and more importantly, listen to them. She encouraged Eric to formally train in psychoanalysis. Perhaps Anna sensed that Eric's own experiences of feeling like an outsider had endowed him with empathy and insight into children's emotional lives. Eric entered analysis with Anna Freud herself and began attending seminars at the Vienna Psychoanalytic Institute. Though he lacked a traditional medical background, making him one of the first lay analysts, Eric thrived in this environment. He absorbed Freud's theories about childhood sexuality and the unconscious, but also began to form his own ideas. Under the mentorship of analysts like Heinz Hartmann and Paul Federn, he specialized in child psychoanalysis. By 1933, he had completed his training and earned a membership in the Vienna Psychoanalytic Society, quite an achievement for someone who just a few years earlier had been a wandering art student. Vienna not only gave Eric a profession, it also gave him love. He met a Canadian-born dance teacher named Joan Serson, who was teaching at the same school. Joan was lively, educated, and had a deep interest in the arts and psychology, a perfect match for Eric. They married in 1930 and soon started a family. Eric formally converted to Christianity, likely more as a formality to ease social complexities than out of devout conviction, and the couple would eventually have four children over the years. For the first time, Eric felt the beginnings of a secure identity. He was a husband, a father, and a respected psychoanalyst carving out a niche working with children. The wounds of his youth weren't gone, but they were salved by a sense of belonging, to a family, to a community of analysts, and to a purpose. However, the dark clouds of history were gathering. In 1933, the Nazis came to power in Germany, and the tide of anti-Semitism surged violently. Eric, being half-Jewish by heritage and associated with Freud's circle, many of whom were Jewish, was under threat. That year, as Nazi students publicly burned Freud's books in Berlin, Eric and Joan made the difficult decision to leave Europe. They first went to Copenhagen. Eric hoped to reclaim Danish citizenship through his birth father's lineage, but this proved impossible due to residency rules. With Europe growing ever more dangerous, the family left for the United States, where citizenship would not be an issue. Arriving in America in 1933, Eric became one of the first child psychoanalysts in Boston and held positions at Massachusetts General Hospital and the Harvard Medical School. This was while he was establishing a singular reputation as a clinician. He was known for his gentle, insightful work with children and adolescents. In 1936, Eric left Harvard to join the Institute of Human Relations at Yale. 2 years later, he began his first systematic studies of cultural influences on psychological development, working with Sioux children at the Pine Ridge Reservation in South Dakota. These studies, and later work with anthropologist Alfred Kroeber among the Yurok Indians of Northern California, helped shape Erickson's theory that while the developmental stages may be universal, the way they are experienced and resolved can differ across cultures. In 1939, Erickson moved his clinical practice and family to California. He had been invited to join a longitudinal study of child development at the University of California, Berkeley, and he also opened a private practice in San Francisco. He was now in his late 30s, firmly in the stage that he would later call intimacy versus isolation. And he had achieved intimacy in both his marriage and his close friendships with colleagues, as well as a sense of purpose in his work. At Berkeley, he taught and continued to refine his ideas about psychosocial development. During the 1940s, Erickson and Jones settled into life in California. Surrounded by the intellectually vibrant community at Berkeley, Erickson felt at home. These were the years he began formulating the 8-stage model that would define his legacy. Observing his own children enter adolescence and working with students and patients in that age group, he paid special attention to the struggles of identity. In 1944, Joan gave birth to their fourth child, a son named Neil. Neil was born with Down syndrome, a fact the Erickson's chose to keep private and which caused them great pain. They placed Neil in an institution as an infant, a not uncommon decision in those days but one that Erickson never discussed openly. The decision left a subtle shadow of guilt in their lives. For a man who emphasized loving care at each stage, entrusting his disabled son to others was a source of private anguish. Some who knew the family noted that it may have deepened Erickson's empathy for what he called the vulnerable and the lost. Generativity, caring for the next generation, took on a complex meaning for Erickson. He poured even more of his energy into nurturing others through his teaching and writing, perhaps channeling some of his unspoken feelings about the son he could not raise. In 1950, Erickson published Childhood and Society, the book that set forth his psychosocial theory in full. In it, he outlined the 8 stages, from infancy's trust versus mistrust to old age's integrity versus despair. The book was a sensation in both academic and popular circles. Here was a framework that extended Freud's stages into the entire lifespan, incorporating social dimensions and giving equal weight to adulthood and old age. And it was written in an elegant, almost literary style, full of clinical anecdotes and anthropological observations from Erickson's experiences with the Sioux and Yurok. The timing was perfect. America was in a post-war identity bloom, with millions of veterans going to college on the GI Bill, navigating identity versus confusion in their own way, and the country as a whole re-examining its values during the Cold War. Erickson's ideas found a receptive audience. Just as he achieved this intellectual triumph, however, Erickson faced a serious professional challenge. In 1950, the University of California, bowing to the McCarthyist pressures of the time, demanded that all faculty sign a loyalty oath swearing they were not communists. Erickson, who believed in the freedom of conscience, refused. Despite not being a communist himself, he found the demand an insult to academic freedom and personal integrity. The refusal cost him his job at Berkeley. He resigned rather than sign the oath. This principled stand was noticed and admired by many. It showed that Erickson was not only a theorist of virtue but someone who lived by his convictions. Nevertheless, losing his position was a blow, and at age 48, with a family to support, he had to find a new path. Erickson accepted a position at the Austin Riggs Center in Stockbridge, Massachusetts, a small and esteemed psychiatric treatment facility. There, from 1951 to 1960, he worked as a clinician and researcher, focusing particularly on youth with emotional troubles. In the tranquil rural setting of Stockbridge, Erickson found an environment conducive to deep thought. He struck up a friendship with Norman Rockwell, the famous American painter who lived in Stockbridge. Rockwell even became Erickson's patient for a time, seeking help for bouts of depression. The two men, each in his own way an interpreter of the American soul, would take walks under the autumn foliage discussing art, identity, and the pressures of living up to one's public image. It was a period of generativity for Erickson. He mentored younger staff, wrote essays, and continued to refine his theories. Joan, ever his partner, co-authored papers with him on play therapy and helped him conceptualize a possible 9th stage of life, which she would publish years after Eric's death, based on their conversations. In 1960, Erickson returned to Harvard, this time as a professor of human development. The campus he returned to was humming with a new generation of students questioning authority and tradition, the early rumblings of the social revolutions of the 1960s. Erickson's presence on campus was electrifying. He taught popular seminars on the life cycle and often spoke publicly about the issues of the day, interpreting the civil rights movement or the emergence of youth counterculture through his psychosocial lens. He saw the sit-ins and protests as youth nationwide grappling with identity and with the 6th stage, intimacy versus isolation, as they formed communities and causes that gave them a sense of belonging. Students flocked to hear the wise professor who could put their personal struggles in a broader context. During this period, Erickson also wrote two books that brought his ideas into dialogue with history and politics. In Young Man Luther, 1958, he examined how Martin Luther's identity crisis, wrestling with faith, authority, and a troubled relationship with his own father, precipitated a societal transformation in the Protestant Reformation. In Gandhi's Truth, 1969, Erickson turned his focus to Mahatma Gandhi, analyzing how Gandhi's experiences of identity, including periods of doubt and ascetic discipline, led him to the concept of satyagraha, truth force, and the strategy of nonviolent resistance. Gandhi's Truth was widely acclaimed and earned Erickson the Pulitzer Prize and National Book Award. These works created the field of psychohistory, blending psychoanalytic insight with historical biography to understand how an individual's inner life can shape the world. In 1970, Erickson retired from teaching, becoming professor emeritus at Harvard, but he didn't cease thinking and writing. The world, too, kept evolving, and Erickson's stages provided a map to many observers trying to make sense of it. The term identity crisis, which he coined, had entered common parlance. In 1973, the United States government recognized his contributions by awarding him the National Endowment for the Humanities Jefferson Lecture Honor. Erickson's lecture was titled Dimensions of a New Identity, delivered before a large audience in Washington, D.C. In it, he addressed the changing identities in modern society, touching on youth culture, women's expanding roles, and even the existential search for meaning in a time of nuclear threats and space exploration. At 71, Erickson still had his finger on the pulse of society's psyche, urging listeners to understand that identity is not a fixed thing achieved in adolescence and then done, but a lifelong journey with new challenges at each stage. Erickson's later years were spent mostly in Massachusetts with Joan, who remained his confidant and intellectual partner. They co-wrote The Life Cycle, completed in 1982, in which they revisited the eight stages and added insights gleaned from the additional years of life they had experienced and observed. Joan, in fact, elaborated on a ninth stage after Eric's death, observing that in extreme old age, people often must revisit all the previous stages in light of their increasing dependence and losses. It was as if life's challenges came full circle, with the very old needing to, for instance, re-establish basic trust in caregivers, as in the first stage, even as they confronted the finality of life, the eighth stage. Erickson found this idea intriguing and humbly admitted that even in his 80s he was learning new things about human development. On May 12, 1994, Eric Erickson died peacefully in Harwich, Massachusetts, at the age of 91. Joan was by his side. The news of his passing was noted around the world. A giant of psychology was gone. Yet, fittingly for a man who emphasized legacy and generativity, his ideas lived on vigorously. In memorial articles, colleagues praised his humanistic vision and his ability to bring hope and meaning to the study of lives. He had showed that development is an ongoing narrative, one that does not stop at childhood, as Freud had largely framed it, but continues to evolve with opportunities for new strengths at every age. Erickson's eight stages of the self have become part of the way we understand our lives. When a new mother frets about giving her infant enough love and consistency, she is, knowingly or not, invoking Erickson's stage of basic trust. When a middle-aged man talks about a midlife crisis and then decides to mentor younger colleagues or devote time to a community project, he is enacting the turn from stagnation to generativity that Erickson described. And when an elderly woman makes peace with past mistakes and cherishes her memories, finding integrity in her twilight years, she is living out Erickson's vision of a life well lived. The power of Erickson's theory lies in its optimistic breadth. It tells us that while each stage has its potential pitfalls, it also offers a path to healing and growth. Even earlier failures can be mitigated by later successes, a point Erickson made when he observed that a negative outcome in one stage, say mistrust or guilt, is not a life sentence. Later experiences can help a person reframe and overcome that earlier challenge. This hopeful view contrasts with deterministic outlooks and has inspired countless therapists to help clients see their struggles as part of a larger human story, not as isolated defects. In reflecting on Eric Erickson's life, one cannot help but notice how beautifully his personal journey mirrored his theoretical model. He knew mistrust as an infant who lost a father, but he also knew basic trust through the love of his mother and stepfather. He asserted autonomy as a youth by wandering his own path, yet also felt shame and doubt in his school years. He exercised initiative in forging a new career, and at times felt guilt for defying expectations. He mastered industry by becoming skilled in psychoanalysis, but he also carried a kernel of inferiority from his uneven formal education. He struggled deeply with identity, then found it in a new name and purpose. He achieved intimacy with a lifelong partner and dear friends. He manifested generativity by guiding others and contributing enduring ideas to society. And in the end, he attained a measure of integrity, accepting the life that was his ooh with all its ironies, and finding peace. Erickson once wrote that in the last stage, if one has been able to take the journey of life and weave it into a coherent story, embracing it as one's own, then a kind of gentle wisdom emerges, a wisdom that knows the world is far from perfect, yet cherishes the value of each stage's lessons. In his final years, Erik Erickson sat with Joan and together they would reminisce about the little blonde boy in Germany who never quite fit in, about the young artist who found himself in Freud's Vienna, about the father who stood up for principle in California, and about the elder reflecting on a century of change. That he could integrate all those selves, outsider and analyst, artist and scientist, rebel and wise man, into one life narrative is a testament to the strength of ego integrity he achieved. Erik Erickson's legacy endures in the framework that so many find illuminating, but also in the example of a life that continually grew, contributed, and understood. In the Eight Ages of the Self, he gave us a roadmap of the human condition, and by living his own stages with honesty and courage, he illuminated the path for others to follow.